mom, who's, as I've stated, awesome. I will never forget, whenever she would talk to the man, if she touched his back in a friendly gesture, she would always touch the wife too. I noticed this, and she told me, I always include her because I don't want her to think I'm flirting with him. My mom isn't even single, but my stepdad wasn't with us. She knew people might talk, that the wife might get jealous. We're just so used to the idea that women out in the world alone must be on the prowl or up to no good. Relationships were easy in my 20s because I deliberately jumped from one to another. It wasn't a fear of being alone as much as just enjoying a steady stream of dudes who liked me. Then one day, my love life stopped being so effortless. And no, it wasn't the moment I turned 30. It's just that as you age, your options start to taper off. You also become more selective about who you spend your time with. People get married, including that one guy you kinda had on reserve. He meets some girl named Allison. They fall in love and move in together and get married on her parents' estate in Connecticut. Allison has a Pilates body and some adorably meaningful job you can't compete with, like curating a children's museum. She has no idea you ever existed, which is funny, since you know that if you rang his doorbell tomorrow, do not ring his doorbell, and said, remember when we did mushrooms at that cabin in Big Bear in 2009 and you said you loved me? I know you still mean it. He would totally leave her. You know it in your heart. Or at least you think you do, but don't go to her house. Stay here. Stay here with me. The three kinds of single. But single women are not pathetic sad sacks or prowling man-eaters, as we all know. There are three kinds of single in my book. This book. Looking. Your girl logic tells you to constantly keep one eye open for the right guy. At the post office, at the bar, riding the subway, walking the dog. Hey, everyone's read the books and seen the meet cute movies. Your girl logic reminds you about all the random schmoes you know who met over a game of Jenga at a coffee shop or a shitty house party they almost decided to skip. Girl logic yells, just go with no expectations and talk to everyone. But, having no expectations is hard because fuck, you got dressed up, slapped on some fake tanner and watched a Saudi Arabian girl's Instagram makeup tutorial on the perfect cat eye. No expectations. I expect a guy to notice. Your girl logic makes you think, oh, but if I don't put on a little makeup and look my best to run this inane errand, there's a slim but very real chance that I might miss out on meeting my one and only true forever soulmate. He's gonna be in line at Trader Joe's and we'll both be holding the same jar of Speculoos cookie butter and he'll just know. And if I miss him, I'll never have a family, never achieve happiness and never feel complete and I will die alone surrounded by happy couples laughing at me. How am I supposed to rest when love is always just around the corner? Anyone who's single is usually in looking mode. 99% of the time, if people say they aren't looking for a relationship right now, it just means they're not looking for a relationship with you. For the most part, people don't knowingly pass up the perfect person. Going on dates, asking friends if they know anyone, attending events or parties you wouldn't normally care about. Oh, who knows who might be there? Keeps you going. Loving it. This is the kind of single euphoria you experience after you've emerged from something suffocating, lame, or just bad. You feel liberated. You want to fart freely, eat deli ham out of a bag, be a vegetable on your couch, and not have to worry about that asshole you were having boring sex with. You want to go out, make out, sleep with whoever you want. You're in personal satisfaction mode, and it is a wonderful place to be. You make up a fraction of that 1% who truly, honestly, aren't looking for a relationship. The lady doth protest too much. You never want to be this girl, but we've all been her at times. This is the one who can't stop telling everyone how much she loves being single. She loves being single. She will even tell it to men she's on a date with because she doesn't want to scare him off. As if some men expect women to be like, sure, let's just fucking chill forever and like see what happens. Time isn't a thing. Babies can happen when I'm 60. Aging skin is valued in our culture. Are women capable of being fine with being single? Of course. But when it's been a while and we can't find a partner, sometimes we half-heartedly resign ourselves to being single, adopting a passive-aggressive fuck you attitude toward the universe. Oh, you meant for just me to be miserable and alone. Okay, cool. Then I'm not gonna bother because I know there's no one out there for me who isn't terrible. I'll just go live alone in a toad hole and disappear and make everyone happy. It's hard not to get a little bitter. People always seem to blame the girl for her own romantic misfortune, and they assume she's doomed if she happens to be uncoupled for a while. Is it possible that your ex-boyfriend was just shitty and you were smart enough to ditch him? Is it possible you're choosing to be alone for a while, either because you need to recover from something awful or because you actually like having time to do your own thing and watch a shit ton of TLC? Just like the phases I listed above, there are phases of trying to come to terms with your own solitariness. It's like the grieving process. These phases can severely test your belief in a higher power or your sense of good and rightness in the world. It's hard to believe in karma when you see all these awful people around you finding love while you keep stuttering along on an endless lazy Susan of half-assed kisses and split checks. 5 steps of single grieving. We've all had those breakups that we longed for and initiated and woke up the next day thinking, I'm free! This list is for the other kind of breakup, when you're mourning a relationship you love that felt like it was cut off in its prime. Denial. Your girl logic tells you, I'm single because I'm choosing to be, which is half true. But really, what you mean is you're choosing not to settle, and you're also not happy that what you had ended. Of course it will all be okay, but telling yourself it will be okay sort of denies that right now it fucking sucks, which is the truth, and also okay. Anger. Your girl logic kicks into rageful comparison mode. Why? Why does that horrible bitch get a boyfriend and a beautiful shiny engagement ring and I'm still single? Why? Her cap teeth don't even look like teeth. Why did Jamie sleep with every guy on Facebook and even sleep with a married man? And as a reward for that, she gets a gorgeous husband who adores her while I get stuck going on a date with some guy named Clark who wears too many leather bracelets and drives a Mini? It's a girl car! And for God's sake, why is he so thin? Bargaining. Your girl logic tries to talk you into why you should stay in, like all the time. I need another night to regroup from not leaving the house. Or the other way, if I go out tonight, then I'll feel better about staying in tomorrow. Or you treat it like the premise of a movie. Okay, universe, I'm gonna go on 37 dates in 37 hours, and if I don't find Mr. Right, I'm gonna stab myself 37 times. Depression. Your girl logic wants you to drag a sleeve of Thin Mints into a cave of self-loathing. No one loves me. The world wants me to be alone. At least I have the toads who also live in this hole for company. Acceptance. Your girl logic comes back around in all her glory. There's a spring in her step. You're ready to face the world again. It is what it is. I'm gonna be fine. I have a date tomorrow. See, your girl logic is on your side again. All of this obsessive thinking and ruminating finally burned away everything that wasn't essential and helped you focus on what's important and what's real. Similarly, women who find themselves single in their 30s come up with various realizations to explain their current circumstance. But I've been in tons of relationships seems to be the most common battle cry I hear among my circle. And sure, you probably were.
In your 20s.
In my 20s, I'd always have a boyfriend for about a year. Then they began to dwindle down to 6-month relationships, then 3-month relationships, and finally just some dates here and there. Eventually, I just kind of felt like I was floating. I can't stomach the idea of being with someone just to avoid being alone, so I didn't force it with people I wasn't truly excited about. There is one silver lining, though. Older single women may get written off as spinsters, witches, hot messes, or too involved with animal rescue, but hey, at least they're not creepy old men. Again, single men aren't typically labeled lonely, pathetic, desperate, or sad. They all get to be called playboys, ladies' men, hard to tie down, the Dos Equis guy, or just sexy bachelors like George Clooney, who eventually bit the bullet and got married. Thank God Amal was smart and age-appropriate. But at a certain age, unattached men who are still pursuing much younger women start drifting into pervy territory. Pervy waters. Don't believe me? Look at any woman's Instagram comments. Once, an older male fan of mine didn't understand why writing, I'd love to place a tender kiss on your perfect lips, was a creepy thing to do, which is the creepiest part. Point is, creepy isn't an adjective assigned to women unless they really try. As women age, we might not be as sexually desirable, but we are still A-okay to hang around kids, schools, and public parks. Also, people don't generally attribute men's singleness to their being lame. They're single because no woman has been special enough to tame them. Newsflash, women do love a project, but no woman can change any man who doesn't want to change. Our girl logic kicks into overdrive when we encounter a mysterious, brooding hunk of dark, unpredictable moods. We become overwhelmed by his potential, And we tell ourselves we're obviously the only woman alive special enough to coax him out of his shell. Because girl logic's dangling a carrot in front of us, making us think, I'm special enough to change him. Women put up with a lot. And I do it too. I do it with guys who aren't even real. I watched Game of Thrones and actually thought, wow, Ramsay Bolton is cute and mysterious in a misunderstood, undiagnosed way. I know he loves torturing people, but I feel like he could change. If he got a chance at real love with someone like me, who knows what kind of adorable butterfly would flutter out of his hardened rapist shell? But think of all the free time women would have, all the mental energy they'd save if they could turn off girl logic and stop constantly obsessing about being single. Men don't seek out relationships the way the majority of women do. Maybe it's a California thing, but I see guys every weekend going surfing, backpacking with the boys, or staying in to unwind. Of course girls partake in leisure too. It just feels like a lot of men are doing it to get away, while women are doing it to show off how much fun they're having on social media, while obviously not thinking about boys at all. There is a dusty, arid hole in the earth in Los Angeles called Runyon Canyon. Go there any day of the week and you'll see anyone from celebrities to jeans-clad Estonian tourists hiking. It's dog-friendly, which is great. Dogs love to pee there, and on really hot days, your hike is enhanced by the smell of warm dog urine baking in the sun. I went there alone for a few days in a row, and I did something a little weird. I simply listened to the snippets of conversation I heard as people passed me. About 70% of the 50-ish conversations I heard were women talking about men. Bits like,
and his work has just been so crazy.
I don't want to look crazy. I can't keep texting him.
But we had so much fun.
And of course, the occasional positive tidbit too. The point is, the primary subject of most women's conversations was men. The other 25%? Women talking about other women, and mostly in a negative way.
I love her, but she tries way too hard.
The other 5% was anything from politics to job complaints. I even heard one girl talking about how the secret to great skin is to not use water when washing your face. If anyone listening has any insights on this method, I'm all ears. Of the men I spied on, less than 10% of their conversations were about women. The majority were about sports, apps, activities, movies, you know, life stuff. I did this survey because I wanted some empirical evidence that women are spending too much time talking about relationships while men are just out there, living life, failing to freak out about dying alone. It's possible they're freaking out internally. I didn't probe that deeply. And as much as I hate this data, the fact is that men don't have to freak out because their biological clocks aren't ticking as loud. Men don't have to try, especially if they have table manners and a decent job. Age and beauty are fleeting, but money and power are seemingly forever. Don't tell that to the ancient Romans or anyone who's ever declared bankruptcy, though. Sometimes our girl logic lets us relax into accepting our own singleness for a minute, because the alternative is too exhausting. We need some downtime to recuperate, chug some Gatorade, and take a breather before we get back out in the game. I felt this way after a bunch of lame dates. I don't want to text this new guy. I don't want to put on a strapless bra and talk with another stranger about my favorite movies while feigning interest in what part of Pittsburgh he's from. Nope. Tonight I'm calling 3 friends. We're going to drink expensive liquor at my house, take muscle relaxers because why not, maybe go to a bar for another round, come home and order food. And I'm not going to wear makeup, except maybe a tiny amount of mascara and concealer and lip gloss. Who knows? I might meet my soulmate tonight. Chapter 8.
Girl on Girl.
In a perfect world, all women would support each other no matter what. But we're all human. We like some people, we loathe others, and we're meh on the rest. And none of us are immune to the idea that we're all somehow in competition for this thing called happiness. I'll confess, sometimes when I meet another woman who looks like competition, I might catch my girl logic fussing. What does she have that I don't? How can I get what she has? More coconut oil? Deeper breathing? What do I have that she doesn't? Is she funny? Can she fill out boy shorts? I suspect this urge to compare ourselves is part of a survival instinct left over from when we all lived in huts. We've gone from, how did she find that fruit? To, how did she get that job? And why is her skin so dewy? Where did she get all those promo codes on Instagram for highlighter kits? Then I remind myself, I'm funny. I have that. And most of the time, I just move on, because life is too short to obsessively compare. Plus, You know what feels better than enduring the endless mental loop of why her, why not me? To simply compliment her and ask, I'm so impressed. How did you get that blank? It feels so good to make someone else feel good. And who knows, you might learn something like, girl, I use barbecue sauce on my skin. Can you believe it? It's hard to stay above the fray, though, when you're a woman in a male-dominated industry. I read a lot of comedy interviews, and journalists always inquire about what various artists think of each other. When they ask male artists about each other, the reporter tends to do it from a good-natured place. They assume there's a mutual respect already there, because, well, they're men. But when they ask me about other women, it can feel like they're trying to start a fight, like they want me to bash the other comedian. Goading me into turning on other women makes a journalist's job easier, and he can crank out a careless story about women hating each other. I get it. It's more fun to think we loathe each other. If we have beef, we might fight. And if we fight, who knows, gentlemen, we might start clawing each other and then ripping each other's shirts off. And then, duh, we all know the next step after that is a full-on lesbian makeout session for you to watch. Why do well-meaning women, women who know better, feminists even, feel the need to tear each other down? Frankly, I think it's because no matter how much progress this society has made, there are still limited opportunities for women. Women are left desperately trying to reassure ourselves, whether it comes to men, money, kids, or jobs, that there's enough to go around. And sometimes there is, but sometimes there just isn't. And feeling starved for opportunity can make anyone a little competitive. To me, one of the most powerful elements of feminism is the acknowledgement that women are multifaceted beings with the freedom to do, think, feel, and say what we wish. This includes getting to decide who I like and don't like based on the criteria that I choose. If you take anything away from my version of feminism, know this. Real feminists judge everyone based on their actions and character. They don't hold it against you that you are a woman, but they won't give you special treatment because of it either. That's the world I'd like to live in. In my act, I've joked that women hate each other, even our closest friends. Oh my God, Stacey's such a bitch. No, I love her. I do. I'm just saying. And I meant it when I said it in my 20s, when life was one big whirligig warpath of new experiences and none of us knew who we were or what we were doing. Oh, awesome. I can drink myself sick while I live with three other girls in a two-bedroom railroad apartment and smoke pot and eat mystery Thai food at 4 a.m. and still get up for my crap day job at 8 a.m. and attempt horrible sex with my neighbor who I secretly really like while I'm also still talking to like three other guys. No, heels totally look fine when they're one size too big. No one will notice. Who cares if I got wasted at a work event and cried in the bathroom. Oops, I threw up in some dude's bed. It's cool. Let's all band together and ignore that one friend. I'm fucking someone from my job. We ignore each other most of the day and then get jealous when the other one flirts with someone else. I'm gonna throw a dinner party at my apartment. Hope you like Chex Mix. And then you're 30. Time flies. But in the 30-something era of newfound adulthood, jealousy and resentment can start cropping up more than ever, especially on the romantic front. It's a struggle out there, as we've determined, and it can feel harder and harder to meet smart, cool men the older you get. This can trigger your girl logic to get panicky and hypersensitive, even with girlfriends. Is there any left for me? When will it be my turn? If we're still looking for partners in our 30s and beyond. For example, a few years ago, a childhood friend, Sarah, got engaged. I was super excited for her. Sarah and I had known each other since we were 14, and as adults in Los Angeles, I'd twice attempted to set her up. The first time was with a comic who turned out to be kind of gross, but he always seemed fine on stage. The other was, another comic. I need to expand my male friend network. And he got her to blow him in a car and then stopped at Subway before dropping her off. Not a red letter day for either of them. Point is, I tried. So Sarah got engaged and asked me to meet her fiance. I did, and he seemed lovely. After dinner, I texted her, James is wonderful. I'm so happy for you. Let me know if he has any cool single friends. Winky emoji. She texted back, trymatch.com, babe. No caps, no punctuation, no emojis. I felt stung. And when I replied that I can't do match because I'm on TV sometimes and that would get weird, she wrote back, don't know what to tell you, XO. I'd love to tell you that I didn't feel a little hurt after reading those texts. Not because she told me to try match, but because she seemed so curt and unhelpful. Maybe I overreacted or misinterpreted. Maybe other women would have blown it off as no big deal. But in that moment, my girl logic started spinning out, And as per usual, the first thing it told me was, see, there is no one left in your friend network to meet. Everyone else is taken. Hurry up before it's only you and a cockroach left in the bargain bin. When I considered how to reply, my girl logic gave me several options. The first was freak out and assume my friends secretly despise me. But being raised as a lady, girl logic quickly reminded me that she probably didn't mean it the way it sounded. After all, it is a text and they're often misinterpreted. Girl logic also told me that this was my friend, and although she hurt my feelings, if I lost it on her now, I'd just look like an asshole in a moment that was supposed to be joyful. But I'd been supportive. I'd even sat through a long dinner where all they did was kiss each other. It felt like, because she'd found her own happiness, she had better things to do now than care about mine, even for a text or two. It's reality. Your girlfriends love you, but when it comes to your romantic life, they're often too preoccupied with their own to think about helping you improve yours. It's a sad hidden truth of our girl logic. While we rely so heavily on our friends, we also secretly compare ourselves to them and pity them, and some of us might bail or fade away altogether when our circumstances have shifted and we don't have as much space in our lives for them anymore. Don't get me wrong, I understand the excitement and warm fuzzies that coincide with being in a new couple. I also get that the lives of your single friends can sometimes start to look just a tiny bit sadder when you've found love yourself. You sit at dinner, clutching your new boyfriend's hand while your single friend talks about some lame date who kept bringing up how much he tipped the waiter while insisting his brand new motorcycle jacket, the one that's so stiff it makes him look like he's peeking out of an S&M game of whack-a-mole, just needs breaking in. And you look at your friend and listen to her horror stories and think to yourself, oh my God, I am so glad I'm in a relationship and no longer relegated to that miserable dating prison. And you feel warm and safe. Then, one day, maybe your relationship ends. Bam! You're back to being one of the inmates in Gen Pop, thinking, how the fuck did I end up here again? And you go crawling back to your girlfriends for protection, who almost always take you back, because they understand. Women aren't entirely to blame for this hardwired sense of girl-on-girl competition. We were dealt a shit hand before Adam and Eve. Wait, we had Lilith, too. Yes, she came before Adam and Eve. Lilith was created as Adam's equal, not sprouted from his rib like Eve. And she was expelled from the Garden of Eden because she wouldn't be submissive to Adam. He banished her and made a 2.0 model he wanted to control. Eve. Remember you were told Eve was made from Adam's rib? Guess what? A rib is a bone. A bone is a metaphor for a dick. The Bible wants you to know that Eve was made from Adam's dick for Adam's dick. What? That's right. She was made to serve him. Which is why when she decided to eat from the tree of knowledge and started having her own thoughts, she became the know-it-all who corrupted Adam because she made him eat the apple. And to pay for it now, women have agonizing childbirth. That's how the Bible story goes, right? Well, I chose to look at it like she was curious and didn't want to chill in the garden where there was no Wi-Fi. She got bored and said, I want what I can't have. I'm a woman. And ate the apple, which prompted her to be like, fuck yeah, I want more knowledge. How do cows work? What's air? Why aren't there any non-evil cable companies? So God punished her for wanting to learn, and Adam was just a poor hot dummy who went along with it. Side note. The idea that clothes weren't even invented, but still Adam and Eve were like, hey God, we're hiding from you because we're naked, doesn't make sense. Somehow, though, we ignore the stupidity of the story while retaining the assumption that women are evil temptresses, not ambitious creatures with a thirst for knowledge. Point is, from the get-go, it's been excruciatingly difficult for women to be strong and make our way in this world. We've had to fight hard for everything we've achieved, and sometimes we've had to fight each other. We're taught to do it. We're trained to do it, and our most reactive base-level girl logic tells us we have to do it to get what we want. It's girl logic, or sometimes just instinct, to not like a woman who feels like a threat. Say your boyfriend's Eva Mendez look-alike new boss, or Sharon in marketing who nabbed that shiny award you were angling for, or your best friend's new sidekick who's suddenly stealing her away every other night for girls' nights out, and when you say you don't like her, your friend's like, really? Jamie's never said anything bad about you. And you're like, exactly! She doesn't even mention me. At least I have the decency to talk shit on her. Cut to immediately feeling like judgmental garbage. So what if Jamie's a member of Soho House? I know a bar that has free popcorn. I'm here to tell you, you can't always heed your girl logic. Sure, it's just trying to protect you when it decides that Sharon is an underhanded asshole trying to steal your job. Though the irregular, sometimes irrational headphone cord knots of girl logic might kick in to freak out mode and tell us other women are out to get us, it's on us to choose how we react, to take the high road, and attempt to act from kindness instead of fear or pettiness. When I finally left my 20s behind, I realized that women don't have to hate each other. To my credit, I've never disliked other women because they were beautiful. I've always been a neo-feminist, meaning I've never blindly accepted a woman or anyone simply because of her gender. If I don't like a woman, it's because she's shitty, not because of how she looked. I can't stand fake people, and if you suck, I can't sit through brunch with you. Any woman I might not have initially liked through ignorance, sense of perceived threat, or whatever, I've overcome by being nice to her and simply introducing myself. Okay, fine. If you're jealous of Scarlett Johansson and you try to conquer that by introducing yourself randomly to her at a Starbucks, her security might intervene. But for me, when it comes to other comics, colleagues, or women at auditions, all it takes is a hello and sometimes a compliment. Remember, everyone wants to be liked. People respond kindly if you are kind. It really is that simple most of the time. Of course, it's not like all my female friendships are all Moscow mules and sunshine. Occasionally, you'll have to confront a friend about saying something dumb, behaving weirdly, or just hurting your feelings. The important thing to remember when your head is spinning in that kind of situation is that when you speak from your highest self, from a perspective of truth and love, nothing bad can truly happen. When you confront a friend, if you approach it from a place like, I want to let you know I'm hurt and I want to resolve it, your intentions are pure. Even if she reacts negatively, that's her deal. It's not on you. Instead of stewing and freaking out, you can use your girl logic to help you map out the best and worst case scenarios. My friend cares about me, so she'll want to fix this. We'll both end up feeling totally fine about things again. If I bring this up and she shuts me down, oh well, worst case comes true and she isn't my friend anymore, or we take a break to figure shit out and discuss it later. Either way, using your girl logic to help you plot the right course can help avoid pitfalls, reduce anxiety, and do the right thing when it comes to dealing with hiccups in your relationships with other women. As I've told you, building close female friendships hasn't always come easy for me. Because of that, I appreciate the girlfriends I have today even more. At this age, friendships aren't convenient. No, the stakes are high and life is hectic. If you don't have the scaffolding of school and work to support your friendship and you still stay close, that means you really love each other. I remember visiting Calgary once and I dropped into a comedy club to do a guest set. I laid low in the back of the room, sort of kept to myself. This woman came bouncing over to me. She was in her early 40s and had just huge hair. She giggled and said, "My name is Lori Gibbs. I'm a comedian here and I want to be best friends with you." It was the beginning of my career, so I hadn't met many other women on the road, let alone women who were this pumped to meet me. We talked and talked and became friends. She's a comedian, housewife, mother of two, and she has a "have fun" tattoo on her arm. I mean, who wouldn't want to be friends with this woman? That was over 5 years ago. Now she features for me regularly, and I stay at her house whenever I play Calgary. We spend our weekends together stalking people on Facebook, napping, crafting, and doing stand-up. She feels like my home when I'm far away. Another time, a few years back, I was on the Comedy Store's patio, and a girl came up to me with her parents. It was sweet. They'd been fans since I was on Last Comic Standing, and the girl was a comedian herself, a friend of a friend. She was cool, smart, funny, and just so charming. We became friends, and she decided to move to New York to do stand-up there. Our friendship morphed from a fan thing to a mutual respect, and now she features for me whenever I play the East Coast. Her name is Kate the Wasp, and she's awesome. You should look her up. Do I befriend every woman or female comedian who talks to me? No. But I appreciate women who aren't trying to get something out of me, who bring not just humor, but hustle. These women were going to work hard with or without me, and I respected that. I'm glad they were willing to come up and say hi and be vulnerable. It makes me more likely to want to be that way, too. It's also nice to be reminded that in such a competitive industry, we truly can be friends. Of course, I'm not some socially evolved feminist goddess who's risen above ever feeling threatened by another woman. Sure, I've matured, but I'm still a person. I'm still a girly person. But I never wake up in the morning setting out to be any sort of monster to other women or anyone else. Okay, maybe I fantasized about a few arguments, but they never come to fruition. But I like to think we all start our days with the best of intentions, with our girl logic leading us toward being bright, gleaming white lights of potential. Then our days roll on, and our girl logic might start growing muddier after we check Twitter and encounter sweet missives like, "You're a dumb bitch and I hope your dog dies." While I know said assholes are losers with their accounts set on private, sometimes I can't help but think to the universe, "Really? I haven't even opened my other eye yet, and this is the first thing you throw at me? Bright white light gets downgraded to an eggshell white, or a beigey coffee stain white, or a burn cream with blood splatters. By the end of the day, after rejections, harassment, dropping your phone 5 times, your flip-flop broke, watching the news, realizing your vote didn't count, breaking up, shitting your pants, whatever, your soul has morphed from luminescent light to a dull poop brown. By now, your girl logic might be telling you to check the fuck out, curl up in a ball, and hide away from the world. At least until tomorrow. And you know what? Sometimes you should curl into a ball. Sometimes the energy of a day is so fucked, all you can do is go home, turn off your Twitter, sleep it off, and see what the lottery brings you tomorrow. Chapter 9. The Unfunny Chromosome. Women are so afraid of not being liked, or worse, being misunderstood, that we sometimes bite our tongues or don't act on our best impulses. Girl logic is constantly assessing the ins and out of every scenario from every angle, and it can become overly preoccupied with being liked, with perpetually maintaining the facade of the nice, good, sweet girl. For example, when a guy says something shitty to you out of nowhere, your girl logic might shut you up because you don't want to cause drama instead of knocking him out, a risky and potentially illegal move, or laying into him. As women, we don't have the luxury of saying, fuck it, here comes the boom, because of the magnified potential ramifications on every front, physically, emotionally, and professionally. And sure, taking the high road is usually the right thing to do, but sometimes we want to fire off a warning shot. Let someone know, hey, by the way, I could destroy you. We don't do it, though, because we see too many ways it could go wrong. God, I wish I were less thoughtful. Sometimes I envy crazy people. What if someone in your office talks down to you? What if speaking up could affect your shot at a promotion? What if you're working at a comedy club and the MC keeps demeaning you by calling you a sexy, funny lady to your own room full of fans? What about when you're going out and you don't feel like dressing up and you say, fuck it, I'm wearing overalls and dressing for me, and then oops, it turns out that was the one time you actually needed to care because all of your crushes from high school and the movies are in one bar. Girl logic is about wanting to make yourself happy and make everyone else happy. And sometimes you end up making yourself unhappy because you're trying to make everyone happy. Ah. The truth is, the more successful you are, the more respected you are when you call the shots. That MC who wouldn't stop bringing up my looks and gender, I told the club manager if he did it again, he would be fired. The guy was so scared that he not only gave me a sanitized intro, he didn't step foot in the green room the rest of the weekend. And do you know what gave me the confidence to request that I be treated professionally? I had sold out the weekend. I had money on my side. Working as a comic has drilled this lesson into my being over and over again. It's invaluable, but it can hurt. To me, being a stand-up comedian is kind of like being an X-Man. You're born that way. From a young age, stand-up comedians have a natural proclivity for observation and introspection. But when I started out in stand-up, I knew nothing about show business. I had never even heard of any comedy club other than the Addison Improv, and that was because I passed it on my drive to high school every morning. I would always check the marquee to see who was there. What's so trippy to me, even to this day, is remembering the names that were up there when I was 16, and now those comics are my colleagues. Still blows my mind. Because I was funny growing up, it never occurred to me that women weren't funny, or that other people might not recognize them as such. I was funny, Ellen was funny, Paula Poundstone was funny, all the SNL women and sitcom stars like Roseanne and Brett Butler, they were funny. It sucks, but women have to go above and beyond, be extra creative. Oh, you're in a sketch troupe playing the ditzy southern girl, or the hot dumb girlfriend, or the mom. Oh, what a creative character choice. But for the longest time, those were all the options girls had. You almost had to earn your way up to the unique characters. You had to fight the typecasting and kick your way to the top to get to showcase a character like Mary Catherine Gallagher or Colette Reardon on SNL or Megan Mullally as Karen on Will and Grace or all of the women on Golden Girls or anything Laurie Metcalf has ever done. You had to deal with years of 20-something white guys getting the good lines in the sketches and the good stand-up spots and the immediate acceptance from the audience. As a woman, you had to know you had something special to create. What I didn't know before I started was that it would be such a fight. No one told me. When I started out at 22 or so, I knew nothing but my jokes. I didn't know how agents worked. I hadn't grown up studying stand-up. I just knew that there were people out there being funny for a living, and I was going to be one of them. I didn't have a concrete goal. The extent of my preparation for Hollywood was writing sketches for my friends, filming them in my living room, and then editing them on a mini DV tape. God, I spent a fortune on those. In college at Emerson, I wrote and produced a ton of sketch comedy, and at the end of school, I did a one-woman show. This is a rite of passage for most creative women, venturing onto the stage alone, living and dying by your own comedy. It's a puddle of simultaneous giddiness, exhilaration, anxiety, and loneliness, and it is worth every well-timed minute. Also, performing in a one-woman show during college is the only chance most women have to expose their breasts in the name of art. I chose not to, but I would probably do it now, for the likes. See, college is a safe space for women to artistically explore their own sexuality. You're given free rein to dress provocatively, to turn on your audience, to use yourself as a character of sorts. Tangential side note, in college, all of my acting friends wanted to be in a student film where there was a sex or rape scene. It's kind of funny and kind of disturbing, but honestly, who could blame them? Art is a perfect guise under which it's A-okay to explore the vulnerability of sexuality without being punished for it. And I was certainly not above attempting to be sexual on screen. Somewhere, there exists footage of a 15-year-old me fake crying in the shower after an off-camera rape scene. We shot it at camp. I was in a Tommy Hilfiger bathing suit. It was highly inappropriate for a Summer Session 1 video production. 17 years later, I ran into the kid who directed that film. I was drunk at 1 a.m. at South by Southwest, and I said, "Oh my God, you have a tape of me at 15, half naked and fake crying." And without missing a beat, he said, "I know, I can't show anyone or I'll go to jail." When I started out in 2005, doing stand-up about women's bizarre behaviors wasn't a thing like it is today. I was the only comedian getting up there as a young woman and, without being overtly crass, talking about the everyday girl experience, our behaviors, expectations, our desires, and our kooky inner monologues. Everything from wedges to being obsessed with fall. I talked about girl logic. The constant barrage of information we would use to plan a night out. Do we share tapas? Can we split a bottle? Should we text boys? Which boys? What if we text boys and only the ones we don't like show up? What if we text and two that we like show up? Should I bring a jacket? What if I have to carry it? What if I have to walk far and look cute? But what if I'm cold? Do I have cash for a cab? What if we want to eat late night? What if my shoes hurt my feet? Will I look weird if I wear flats? Soon, shows like Girl Code, a show that's just girls talking about being girls, appeared. Then there were excessive numbers of mean-spirited, mocking Instagram accounts. If you haven't noticed, there are tons of accounts that exist for the sole purpose of making fun of women's makeup, bodies, clothes, anything and everything. One recent meme said something like, "She doesn't do gluten, GMOs, or processed anything, but she pops MDMA for 2 days straight at Coachella." As if there aren't plenty of men out there with similar food restrictions who drink to excess and do mountains of blow and HGH or drink Gatorade with dinner. Where are the accounts picturing some ugly bald dude noting he can't talk to girls, is a little racist, and is unhealthily close to his mom, but he made $5 million last year with an app, so he's allowed to be a monster? And the fact still remains that if and when there are memes making fun of men, the impact isn't felt as fully for men as it is for women, since women are already under constant attack. There are thousands of accounts endlessly enforcing the idea that your vagina has to be perfect, your body has to be flawless, and as long as you're being bae, you're cool. If these accounts are run by men, or worse, women, they're just feeding into our society's desires to make women seem inherently awful. I'm not saying that some of them aren't funny. What I'm saying is that shitting on women is ubiquitous. Anyway, back to stand-up. You don't have to be especially tough to do it. Sure, it requires sufficient inner fortitude to deal with rejection, but other than that, you don't have to process much other than a strong sense of self and a burning desire to share your observations with the world. I knew I was funny, because that was the staple compliment I'd received all my life. Of course, I didn't know how many terrible guys I'd come up against after winning Last Comic Standing in 2008. Since I had no professional stand-up experience at that point, winning LCS was a little like trying to get into the military but skipping basic training and heading right to buds. When I auditioned for LCS at 25, I still had a day job in an office. I worked as an assistant at a company called the Ultimate Blackjack Tour, or the Ultimate BJ Tour, as I would call it when I instant messaged my friends at work. I was the assistant to the head of marketing, and my duties included making copies, putting together press kits, and faking being awake at 10 a.m. when I was hungover. It was genius. I would pull up a Word document, prop my head up to look like I was reading, and fall asleep. I had a passion for neither blackjack nor marketing, but it was a good gig. I was proud to have my own cubicle. I remember the day I got offered the job, I called my mom and I screamed, "I'm making $40,000 a year!" To the 24-year-old me, new to the corporate world, it may as well have been $1 million. I didn't even know what the prize for winning that damn reality show was. I had no real outside guidance or even personal objective. I just knew it would be a good thing if more people could see me doing stand-up. Getting on Last Comic Standing equaled validation. I missed the LA audition because I was in Singapore doing military shows. I flew to San Francisco to audition, did my joke, and got through. That joke may or may not have been about pizza. That is, how shitty pizza places always sell you 3 pizzas for $15 with free cheesy bread and marinara dipping sauce. And I'm like, cheesy bread with marinara sauce? That's pizza! Anyway, I was asked to come back that afternoon for the taped auditions. And the rest is history. I'm only telling you this story about my first break because I want to reveal the realities behind, well, reality shows. At least my experience with them. I went through what should have been a unique, fun, formative Hollywood experience. I'm a woman, though, and women have to work 10 times as hard just to wait for the audience to recover from the fact that we aren't men. So instead of being something inspiring and awesome, my experience on LCS turned out to be a mentally scarring, emotional gauntlet. One component of my season was that the last batch of remaining comics were all sent to live in a house together, have their lives taped, and see what happens when people stop being polite and started getting real. JK, that's a different show, but kind of the same. But really, we did go live in a house together. I'd seen enough reality shows to know that the sole purpose of putting people in a house is to pit them against each other to try to eke out 22 minutes of fantastic TV. I wasn't loud, confrontational, or combative. Not in the house or in real life. I didn't try to be funny or hypersexual or the bitch, even though I knew they needed a bad guy, and I'd heard they were out to make the blonde girl from Dallas look like a bitch. So I decided, from day one, that they would never get anything out of me other than smiles. Certainly nothing negative about any other contestant. I focused entirely on why I was there, which involves some strategy. It was 2008, the prime of reality TV, and I watched all of it. Flavor of Love, Rock of Love, Flavor of Rock. I learned 2 things from these shows. One was how to physically assault another woman you had just had a filthy, drunken 3-way kiss with. The other was in the editing. When the producer sits you down for an OTF, on-the-fly interview, they like to interrogate you about the other cast members. And the second you mention another cast member, the show cuts to footage of them. I worked very hard to stay in that house, so I rarely, if ever, said anyone else's name. I tried to only talk about my own comedy. Hey, I knew what an amazing opportunity I had been given, and I wasn't going to give up my screen time to someone else. I also paid attention to story editing. When you watch a reality show, producers sometimes invent their own creative storyline for each cast member. They can create villains and heroes, editing it however they want to bend reality to their perceptions. You can say something as simple as, I love Steve. Last night Steve made me dinner, and afterward I was so, so full I almost died. But that sweet positive sentiment can quickly translate to, last night Steve made me dinner, insert shot of Steve smiling and cooking, and I almost died, insert shot of you full on the couch but not smiling. All of a sudden, Steve has gone from someone you adore who cooked you an amazing dinner to someone who tried to poison you. Now America hates Steve! At the end of each week, the members of the house got together and put in a vote for who they thought they were funnier than.
Brutal.
After that, the person we said we were funnier than got voted off, but not before having the chance to challenge 2 other comics. Then the 3 of you had to perform in front of a live crowd, which ultimately decided who got to stay. So while I was never weak enough to be voted off, 2 weeks in a row, I was viewed as weak enough to be challenged by the loser who was being kicked off. And each week, I won. And that's why I won the show. Because despite proving myself week after week, day after day, the guys still assumed that challenging the girl was their best shot at staying. I used my girl logic for 1 element of this. I weighed how easy it would be for them to grab a soundbite and make me look like a bitch. I wanted to be liked because of me, and I didn't want to be disliked because of something some producer made me up to be. People expect women to be weak, bitchy, and easily defeated, and I made sure to let them down. Girl logic will sometimes kick in to remind you how things might go awry if you upset people or seem less than likable, but I tried to remain calm and steady, knowing 1 wrong move could turn into producers portraying me as the super bitch. I moved forward, questioned nothing, and did what I had to do. When it came time for America to vote, our fair country had already gotten to know me. Week after week, I was the underdog who wouldn't quit, and they liked that. I won by a landslide. Did I deserve it more than the other guys? In that pantheon, yes. In life, who the hell knows? But I know I didn't deserve it less than they did. I worked my ass off to be there. Now, there's no such thing as deserve when it comes to art. The same rule that allows a three-year in comic to win a national TV show is the same rule that applies when you've made four pilots that never got picked up. It isn't fair, and you never know what could happen down the road. We sign up for that chaos as entertainers. After I won the show, though, things took a decided turn for the worse, at least when it came to the way my male castmates treated me. Fragile egos, I suppose. I'm not using names here because it's not my intention to be a shit talker or rehash something old, but during the course of the season, I'd befriended a hilarious guy in the house. We'll call him Dave. We were good friends, and we spent our nights in the kitchen of that comedy house talking about comedy and music and movies. We both had significant others, so it was nice to just bond as colleagues and castmates. On the night of the finale, NBC threw a party. I spotted Dave, and I was so excited to introduce him to Andriana, my semester at sea friend, who had flown out to Vegas for the finale. But when I tapped him on the shoulder and he turned around, I swear his eyes looked pitch black, soulless and empty. He simply said, "You shouldn't have won. I should have. Good luck following me for the next 4 months." And stormed off. I was floored. I had never had anyone turn on me like that. After the show, me and the four dudes I beat got to do a cross-country tour together. Wahoo. That was the beginning of 4 months of just misery. Day in, day out, mental abuse. Apparently Dave had poisoned the other comics against me, and I had to sit idly by as they all, one by one, quietly stopped talking to me. No one would save me a seat at dinner. No one would sit by me on the bus. No one would say bless you if I sneezed. Nobody would answer if I asked a question. And no one would ever laugh if I made a joke. Not knowing if you're going to be met with hostility, warmth, or just be totally ignored anytime you speak is maddening. This was my introduction to the world of professional stand-up, as a ruthless, bitter, competitive wonderland where people are jealous of you for being what they aren't and despise you for being what you are. But what was I going to do? Not headline the tour I had earned? No way would I quit, and I certainly wouldn't give them the satisfaction of crying in front of them. So I decided to keep getting on the tour bus every week and let them be pieces of shit while I sat quietly on my own and endured. Every day was me putting on a brave face and putting my energy into the set that I'd scraped together to headline the tour. Dave would often go right before me, and he would do his best to bury me at every show. And he was so funny. I have no problem admitting that. Sure, there were shows in which he may have performed better than me, but that didn't change the fact that I was being paid more. I'd won the show. People were coming to see me, and I'm sure that that killed him. All I did to deserve these men's mistreatment was refuse to roll over when they knocked me down. And I know I'm not alone in dealing with this sort of thing from colleagues. It happens all the time. Welcome to womanhood, right? Because you're not willing to disappear or take it, because you just want the respect everyone else seems to command simply because they're bestowed with a dick, you get labeled bitchy or difficult. To make it worse, we all had to do press. Photo ops, newspaper interviews, radio tours, all as one supposedly big, happy comedy family. And of course the journalist would ask, "So, how's the tour going?" For the sake of the show, I lied, smiled through gritted teeth, and claimed we were having so much fun. Ugh. Then one night, one of them called me a cunt. Robert, one of the comics I had become sort of friendly with, seemed gentle before all this. While Dave had strived to make my life miserable at every turn, Robert, it seemed, was unaffected at the beginning. He was indifferent to me, and I took that nugget of apathy as a port in the storm. We'd even gotten pedicures together in one city at the start of the tour. I felt, if nothing else, we had at least become friendly. One night, we were getting drinks at a bar after a show. I guess Robert is a nasty drunk or something, because out of nowhere, he let loose this singer. "You think you're so much better than all of us." As a comedian, there's that split second when someone says something insane that you think they must be joking because had you said something like that, you'd know you'd be joking. But he wasn't. My stomach dropped. This kind of accusation was uncharted territory for me. I also didn't think that at all. Now I do, but I didn't then. "You think you're better than us, and you didn't deserve to win. You're a fucking cunt." The other comics just stood next to him, emotionless, as if he had uttered something as banal as, "I'm going to find the buffet." I turned around and walked away as fast as I could to my hotel room, where I finally broke down crying. Not because he had called me a cunt, but because it felt like he'd been saving up the word for weeks just to spit it out at me whenever he was ready. We had just gotten pedicures. I felt safe with him. He at least had to have a mother. Yet to him, I wasn't a normal woman or human. I was just some horrific bitch who had stolen his last chance at a career and thus didn't deserve anything. Needless to say, the next few tour stops were pretty much the opposite of fun. And I realized that I was protecting the last comic standing brand, a brand that ultimately didn't care about me. Have you seen me on the show since? At the time, I was protecting a bunch of dick comics who seemed to find joy in trampling on my emotions on a daily basis. Exhausted, I gave an interview to a small paper in Florida and admitted that the guys weren't, and I'm paraphrasing this, that cool to me. I put it mildly. I had no desire to embarrass anyone. Of course, all the guys had Google alerts on their names, and the next morning on the bus, Robert stormed at me with a printed copy of the interview, smoke coming out of his ears. "Look what she said about us," he shrieked, his battle cry to rally the others. Apparently, this pathetic one-line statement from me was enough probable cause for them to let loose on me. And finally, finally, I snapped and gave it right back to them. "You motherfuckers are lucky," that's all I said. "I've been fucking protecting you this whole time," I yelled. Robert threatened to hit me. He literally said, "I should punch you in the face." What's funny is, in the moment, I didn't feel threatened as much as sorry for him. Sorry for him that this is what his life had amounted to, threatening me with physical violence. The tough guy in me chuckled a little. "Oh my God, hit me and watch what happens. Watch how your life unravels when people find out you hit a 25-year-old woman." No one hit me. But the screaming fits just escalated all around. Have you ever screamed at someone you weren't prepared to scream at? I could almost feel myself leaving my body as a cold sweat covered me and my voice shook from surprise, uncertainty, and this weird sense of knowing deep down that these fuckers had it coming. Still, I couldn't believe this explosion was happening. When the tour finally wrapped up after a few months, I was left hardened, emotionally and really thin, physically. I remember my manager asking, "Why are you so skinny?" And I said, "I sleep all day because I'm anxious about the guys and I eat one meal alone at the theater." What I gained from that whole nasty debacle, in addition to a new fan base, of course, was an incredibly thick skin. Most likely, nothing I'll ever endure in show business will be worse than that. The whole experience lit a fire under me to never be a victim like that again, to never just take shit because someone thinks I don't deserve what I have. Now I'm a little like your grandpa, you know, the one who's been in combat and has seen some shit. Once you've seen the worst, nothing phases you. I can honestly say that I'm not afraid of any experience, at least not in show business. Real life is still a terrifying mystery, as are white jeans. Before that experience, I worked hard. I would do my job from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m., and then I would find dinner and hit the town to do my spots. 5 minutes at the store, 10 minutes on the west side. One time I drove to San Diego and back on a work night because they gave me 20 minutes. I hustled. I produced comedy shows. I wrote sketches for people. I got stage time anywhere I could. I had energy, and I used every ounce of it. Work ethic is something you can learn, and in some cases, it's in your DNA. My parents divorced when I was 7, remember? Recently, my father and I got in an argument. When parents divorce, there's always a gray area regarding which parent did the most, tried the hardest, all of that. In the heat of our argument, I said something about my father not being there enough. He replied, "You have no idea how much I wanted to be with you. I had to be on the road 5 days a week. I would drive all night on Friday, chugging coffee and listening to the Mets game to stay awake. Also, I could be there to make breakfast for you and your brother on Saturday morning." I hope you appreciated my Long Island accent for that. I learned two things from our interaction. The first was the origin of my road dog work ethic, and the second was that hard work and intention often go unnoticed. All people see is what you don't do, or what they think you should be doing better. There was a comic years ago who was younger than me, still is. Over the course of a few weeks, I would regularly drop in the Comedy Store to refine a routine I was working on for TV. I just needed 5 minutes a night to try out some of the material. One of the benefits of being a paid regular is that you can drop in during certain times and just get on the stage for a couple of minutes, run a few jokes by the tourists, see what's funny. So I popped in, and the MC told me he'd put me up next. The younger comic approached me. "Hey, Eliza, I feel like every time you come in, you bump me. Is it cool if I just do my set? 'Cause I was next." My girl logic whispered, "You aren't trying to be rude, and if he thinks you're deliberately trying to be rude, he will tell other guys, and they will all dislike you. If he gets a show, he won't want you on it. He could become the king of comedy, and you'll be left in the dust, so try not to upset him." Then another part of my brain, a newly built defensive side, screamed over my girl logic, "It's another last comic standing! Don't let him take what's yours! How dare he make this personal and question you!" See, often my girl logic, in the name of self-preservation, has me map out arguments for bad news I haven't even received yet, bad news I actually might not ever receive. I plan it out so that if and when something awful I imagine actually happens, I have a choose-your-own-adventure response instantly at the ready. But when he asked me that question, I was caught off guard, so I temporarily ignored my girl logic and just said, "Okay." After all, it was only 5 minutes, and it seemed to mean something to him. Of course my objective in stopping in that night wasn't to bump him in particular, but that's comedy. People get bumped. Chris Rock can come into any comedy club and the whole lineup falls by the wayside if he wants to do time. I couldn't help but feel that he wouldn't have been as vocal if a successful male comic had dropped in. So after the show, I called him. I couldn't stomach the idea of A, him thinking I was out to get him, and B, him thinking it was okay to just walk up to a woman who outranked him and ask her to, like, chill. When he picked up the phone, I let my girl logic dictate the first sentiment of my call. "Hey, I just want to let you know, when I drop in, I'm there to work on my set. I don't know who's before me or after me, and I don't want you to think I'm targeting you. I'm not." Then, I let my ego do the rest of the talking. "But please, don't tell me not to bump you. You don't get to do that. Just like I wouldn't tell Adam Sandler not to bump me. It's part of the game, and it isn't personal. You don't have the right to say that to me. I've been at this longer than you, and I have more credits." I didn't whine. I didn't sugarcoat it. I spoke to him like a man, and he got it. Whether he acquiesced out of astonishment, fear, respect, I didn't care. But I haven't had a problem with him since, and now we always say hi to each other. See, you teach people how to treat you. If you don't like someone's behavior toward you, educate them. Your girl logic might be urging you to crawl into a corner or to cry or sulk and pretend it's not happening. And of course, you need to pick your battles. We can't flip our shit every time a man addresses us a little oddly. And you might not want to. You don't have to rabble-rouse for gender equality every time a man calls you sweetie. But if you aren't getting the respect you deserve, demand it. Or ignore that person for the rest of your life. Or go out and make your career infinitely better than all those motherfuckers combined. Any of those options should work. Chapter 10. It's all about the at-bats. When it comes to pursuing your passions in life, the stakes are always higher for women. When we have the audacity to pour ourselves wholly into a goal, it can kind of scare people. And the more passionate you are about what you want, the louder girl logic will be ringing in your head, especially when you get pushback from a world that says you're too fat, not pretty enough, too loud, overly aggressive, whatever. But as it is with so many other areas of life, girl logic can be both a boost and a bummer in this realm. It can lay out all the ways you can fail. Fired, not enough views of your videos, producer doesn't watch your tape, and how you might feel afterwards, since failure is part of your rich history as a human who gives a damn. And it can also remind you that there is absolutely no downside to trying. So you try and you fail. So what? You did your best, you still got the lessons. Plus, the more you fail, the less it hurts. My whole life, my stepdad has described chances as at-bats, meaning how many times you're allowed to step up to the plate and swing, hit or miss. You get at-bats because you're good enough to miss and still be invited to the plate. Though I always strive to succeed, who doesn't, I'm allowed to fail, to have at-bats, because I work hard to earn them. Where others give up, I press on. Where others are complacent, I push. I don't do it for any reason other than it's the only way I know how to be. I believe my work ethic was passed on to me by my father. While I have the utmost respect for my mom, who was a single working mom when she raised me, I connect with my father more when it comes to professional ambition. For 27 years, my father worked in men's apparel, things like ties, suspenders, and belts. He spent 27 years on the road as a sales rep, driving all over the country every week. Now, when I'm touring, I'll get calls from my dad on a Sunday. I figured if it's Sunday, you're in an airport flying home. And we'll talk about the city I was just in. He knows all of them, down to a detail like, on 3rd and Washington, there's a restaurant that makes clam pizza. Sounds disgusting, but trust me, it's unfucking believable. My working knowledge of most U.S. cities consists of the immediate area around my hotel and the venue, but my father knows so many cities intimately from pushing giant rolling racks up and down the streets from store to store. After years and years of working for someone else, he started his own line of apparel, named it Novia. I would go visit him in the summers, in his office, in his warehouse. He let me cut swatches of silk and glue them to expensive cardstock as samples for customers. I wasn't great at it, but who is? It's actually really hard to freehand cut a perfect square with pinking shears. I remember going to the factories where they would cut leather and dye alligator pelts that would later be made into belts and braces. I'd crawl past the machines and under the cutting tables to collect leather scraps, positive I could create something special with the shreds of discarded materials. I couldn't. My father did everything himself, putting everything he had into the business. He ran the warehouse, designed the merchandise, boxed it up, and sold it. He would go store to store, meeting to meeting, state to state, to sell them on the idea of carrying his line. He would fly to Lake Como, Italy, to the silk mills,